in this country, in 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
I don't call it ratting, I call it an insurrection.
The whites have become black.
People have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected.
This is not a racial problem. All we say is that we've got enough immigrants into the country, and that no more should be allowed in.
Welcome back to About Race with Rennie Edo Lodge. In the last two episodes of this series, I took a deep dive into the politics of whiteness, looking particularly at how it functioned during key UK elections. You'll notice in those episodes that I was very careful not to use the word black to describe people who are not white. In my work, I use the term people of colour to define anyone of any race that isn't white. And in this episode, I want to dig into the meaning of the word black. One thing I noticed when I was recording for this podcast was how many of my interviewees wanted to talk about this idea of political blackness. Often it came up in our conversations unprompted. Let me tell you a story. In 2016, Kent University Student Union ignited internet anger after they included the pop star Zayn Malik and the politician Sadiq Khan in a poster display for Black History Month. The student union was called a national embarrassment by one of its own members, and the official Twitter account for Black History Month tweeted, "Deeply disappointed at Kent Union's ill-thought and misdirected Black History Month celebrations." With Asian Heritage Month being observed by a growing number of countries in May, will black icons be celebrated at Kent University then? Much press coverage and bewildered commentary ensued. The president of Kent Student Union ended up issuing a statement. It read, "I want to apologise on behalf of Kent Union to any individuals who are upset, uncomfortable, or offended by the image shared. There was no intent for this to happen, and I am very sorry to anybody who felt this way. Whilst we made every effort to include black and minority ethnic students on the planning for the month, clearly we haven't got it right on this occasion." I can understand the anger. I mean, Asian people are Asian, right? Not black. Black people are black. But it appears that this has not always been the case. Kent Union didn't really explain it very well in their initial statement, but it seems that what their poster exhibition was referring to was a political kind of blackness. It's quite difficult to find an official definition, but I understand black, in the political sense, works as an umbrella term in order to be an organising tool against white supremacy. I sometimes call it trade union black, because when I was first getting involved in politics, that's where I first saw it in use. I remember being dead against it at the time. This was on the basis that its use wasn't widespread enough. So, rather than having its unifying intent, it was actually alienating. My stance back then appears to be the consensus now. Have you seen that backlash against the idea?
No, there's been a huge backlash against the idea of political blackness. When we came in 87...
Shadow Home Secretary Diane Abbott, MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington for over three decades, she was the first black woman in Britain to be elected to Parliament. We spoke in her Portcullis House office.
There were...
For the benefit of the tape, Diane's looking for something. What she found? You've got a picture here?
This is a picture of, it's picture of me and Bernie and Jeremy, actually, and Bernie Grant's wife.
So we've got a very young looking Diane here. We've got Bernie Grant. Was he an MP at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was the MP for Tottenham.
Yeah.
Which is where I grew up. Then we've got a very young looking Jeremy Corbyn with a very, very full beard. And a lady on the end who you say she was Bernie Grant's wife?
Sharon Grant. And she was a councillor in Haringey. And Jeremy was a councillor in Haringey also. So, yeah, there's been a huge backlash against political blackness. So when we all got elected in 87, Keith Vaz was actually from Goa. I think he was an Indian from Goa. Paul Boateng, his father was a Ghanaian politician. His mother was English. I think he was born in this country, but he spent a certain amount of time in Ghana as a young person. Bernie Grant was born in Ghana, and I was born here, but my family was from the West Indies. But we had no problem in all calling ourselves black. But from the 90s onwards, there was a challenge to the notion of political blackness. And first of all, people from the Indian subcontinent said, we're not black. And then even within the Indian subcontinent, you had Hindus saying, well, we're not Muslim. And Muslims saying, well, we're not Hindus. And then even in Africa, you had people from Northern Nigeria saying, we're Hausas, we're not black. And you've got Yoruba saying, we're Yoruba. And you've got Igbo saying, we're Igbo. And so what you've seen over the past 20 years is a pushback against the concept of political blackness and increasing fragmentation. Because if it means more to you to assert your identity as a Yoruba, then to assert your identity as a black person, then you're looking at a weakened political push. I mean, my family's from Jamaica. I was born here, my family's from Jamaica. I'm very proud to be Jamaican. I think even though I was born here, I see myself as culturally still, that's my cultural heritage and I'm proud of it. And I think it's important to be proud of your cultural heritage. But I think the extent to which the black community has fragmented and has rejected any notion of political blackness has tended to weaken it. That's my view.
Diane says that as a community, we have lost the notion of collectivism.
I remember going down to Brixton the day after the riots and walking along the streets, and there was broken glass and there was ashes, and it was just extraordinary. So what the riots did, those riots in the early 80s, first of all, I think they built a cohesiveness, because if you were writing on the street, no one was saying, are you Nigerian? Are you from Sri Lanka? Are you Indian? You were a person of colour and you were rioting. But also, they made the society stop and think about issues around black representation, which I'd never thought about before. Clearly, as Shadow Home Secretary, I'm not saying that I support violence in any form, but there's no question, historically, that the reason you were able to get black people elected to parliament at all was not because people turned around and said, oh, I know, this will be nice, let's have black people in parliament. It was a convergence. So what happened in the 80s, which was the election for the first time of four self-defined black MPs being elected in 1987 for the first time, myself, Bernie Grant, Keith Vaz, and of course Paul Boateng. But you also had, around the same period, you had the emergence of black council leaders like Bernie Grant and Linda Bellos. And I think that the emergence of that early generation of black council leaders, and specifically the emergence of Paul and Bernie and Keith and myself, owes everything to the urban insurrections of the early 80s. There's a convergence, actually, of a generation of struggle and activity by people like the Race Today Collective. It was a convergence of the kind of really seismic effect on the society of the riots. And the fact that, I mean, the people I refer to as black leaders in the 80s, like, as I say, John LaRose and Farouk Dondi and Dark Sound and so forth, were born abroad without any exception. So the point was that my generation was the generation that was born here. And our slogan, our favourite little slogan, was here to stay, here to fight.
In episode 1, I spoke to Farouk Dondi about his time as Channel 4's Multicultural Commissioner, but he was also a committed member of the British Black Panther movement during the 1970s. He's South Asian.
I found the Black Panther movement extremely impressive. Hmm. They were talking sense. They were not talking cult of leadership. Hmm. They were not talking back to Africa, black nationalism. Hmm. They were talking about how do we find a place in British society here with all the rights that we should have. And the leaders, a very charismatic young lady from Trinidad called Althea Jones. At the time, she was undoubtedly the leader, right? She was a student. She was doing university medical students. They saw that I had done my reading on socialism and so forth. And so they recruited me to the movement, and I soon became a member of the Central Core, right? There was no colorism in the Black Panther movement. Obviously, there were no white members. There were supporters, associates, but the membership was basically Asian and black. They saw it as a common fight against the ex-colonial masters.
Farouk told me about the horrific racism he faced when he first moved to England.
The simplest one was they never served you in pubs. If you went as one or two or three or four Asians in a group, your friends, you went to a pub, they stood you at the bar and they'd ignore you for half an hour, even though you said, "Sir, can I have a glass of beer? Sir, can I, you know, you, excuse me, please." They wouldn't listen. Landlords, we were poor. We lived in bedsitters if we could afford it, because we earned our money walking dogs, cleaning flats, as ex-graduates who didn't have a regular job. And you couldn't get a bedsitter unless it was from, say, a Pakistani landlord, you know, or somebody who said, "Okay, we'll give you this dirty room." So you had the dirty room. You shared the bathroom with 28 other people. Mm. If you went to a house which was, say, South Kensington or even Notting Hill, they'd say, "Sorry, the room's just gone." You wandered around for days, sleeping on friends' floors and trying to get a room of your own. And then, of course, on football nights, I met with people coming up the escalators who'd give you a slap as they passed or just catch you because you didn't look as though you were a supporter of Celtic or Arsenal or God knows.
He was living above a squatted bookshop in Brixton named Freedom News in the early 1970s.
We'd sell black literature, black history from there and so on. I lived on the second floor, and one day on the 15th of March 1973, I woke up with the whole place full of smoke. I thought somebody was smothering me with a pillow. And I got up and I couldn't see anything. Opened the window of the second floor, took a deep breath. The whole place was on fire. Freedom News bookshop, the glass was bursting outwards of the fire. That's what happens. Somebody had bombed the place.
Farouk told me that he and many others believed that the far-right National Front were behind the bombing.
I had to jump out of the second floor window, broke my ankle and got burnt and this and that. Mm. That was the worst case of racism that I have faced. Somebody trying to kill me with a firebomb.
I'm going to ask if the police ever caught them, but I think I already know the answer.
They never did a word. The police never even questioned me. They did not want to know.
I mean, how do you feel about that, that backlash against the idea of trade union black political black?
It's the most disgraceful thing that has happened to our ex-colonial community. I used to call them new communities. Now they're not new communities. They're now pretty damned established communities, beginning with your generation or even with the generation above. And the disparity between new communities or any hostility between them is absolutely shameful. It's a kind of nationalism has taken over. There was such a strong back to Africa movement that we are Africans and we have African culture, this, that, the other. One of my greatest friends was a black philosopher who lived in my house for a year called C.L.R. James.
And there's, of course, a library named after him in Hackney.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. He lived with me. He had no disrespect for Africa. But he said, look, over the last 300-400 years, we have become part of Western civilization. We are part of, and clear phrase, the Western intellectual tradition. And our ancestors are not some tribal chief, but Shakespeare, Beethoven, Mozart, Karl Marx. That's who we have, through the force of history, become. Absolutely no antagonism towards adopting African cultural modes. He said jazz is the contribution to Western classical music that Black Americans have made.
There is a link there. But also, I feel that despite the fact that we are part of that the Western intellectual tradition, we constantly have to fight for and defend our place in it.
We've been trying to do that for years and years and years. And it sort of works, you know. In my generation, no Black woman would be allowed to run a podcast institution. They wouldn't have written books, right? They wouldn't have. There has been progress.
One key contention with political Blackness is that it doesn't account for anti-Black attitudes among people of colour who are not of African descent. I put this to Farouk.
One could say that in a general Asian community, you would find prejudice against Black people. And in the Black community, you'd find prejudice against coolies, as they called Asians, right? Not in the political movements, obviously, right? But certainly there would be in some kind of shopkeeper mentality or some Bangladeshi communities, they'd say it's because of the Blacks that this is happening. And in some Black communities, they say these people are, well, not us. But of course we were fighting that.
I think that there is a generational divide on this issue. Many of the members of the feminist activist group, Sisters Uncut, were barely twinkles in their parents' eyes when Diane Abba MP and Farouk Dondi were organising in the 70s and 80s. I'm interested to know what the younger generation of activists think about the concept of political Blackness. I spoke to two Sisters Uncut members, Angelica and Kelsey, about the issue.
I think Sisters as a group doesn't really, we don't organise under the banner of political Blackness.
That's Angelica's voice.
Yeah, it's not really a phrase that's thrown around.
And that's Kelsey's voice.
Or said much in our circles.
Why
I think
is that?
It's kind of old
it's
school.
Just people of colour, I think, we use to mean anyone who's not white.
What do you mean by old school?
Just like you said, it has a very specific like history and context. I know like the NUS was still using it for a while.
Used in a lot of union spaces.
Union spaces, yeah. And I think that is reflective of that kind of 70s, 80s political, like British political tradition. Sisters was founded in 2014. I guess
in terms of the concept as well, like we don't tend to lump everyone together. Like we are aware of like specific anti-Blackness and things like that. Like, and that there are different privileges within the range of people of colour. So it's, we don't tend to like organize as if like everyone is having exactly the same experience or anything.
I think
that makes sense.
So what I can glean from the original uses was not really that everyone's having the same experience, but rather we are all uniting against the same power structure.
Yeah, it was strategic.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I, for a lot of people, I think of our generation in terms of organizing, they are so adamantly against the idea of like political Blackness. They think it's like insulting, it's offensive. I personally don't have that position. Like I appreciate what it was at the time, and I understand like the certain, like the conditions out of which that was born. But it's not a hill that I'm willing to die. For some people, they'll say, if you organize under political Blackness, like I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna F with you. Like that's messed up. I personally don't feel the same way.
I think discussing identity is only useful insofar as it can be used to look at structural power. My main concern is analysing the political power of whiteness. So I really don't want to get stuck in conversations about who's Black and who isn't. But then again, I'm so obviously of West African heritage that my race is never called into question. But that's not the case for every person of colour. I had a really interesting conversation with the rapper, author and activist Akala about this very issue.
I identify as black because that's my upbringing. Obviously, I'm biologically mixed and I recognise that and I don't deny any of my heritage. And I think it's a different conversation. When I have a conversation with a person who has two black parents, like yourself, and they're like, well, if you're black, then what am I? I have two black parents. What's the difference? I think there's a different internal conversation among people racialized as black where I am happy to say, well, yes, obviously I'm mixed. My problem is that most mixed people who emphasize their mixedness, in my humble opinion and from looking at the history of it, is to emphasize I'm not black. It's not to say, look, I have this position, I'm caught between two worlds in a world partly governed by white supremacy. The tradition of what I'll call mulatto nationalism has always been a regressive political tradition, whereas black nationalism, I mean, the most famous black nationalist of all time, Bob Marley or Marcus Garvey, both Jamaicans, one's mixed. How was black nationalism broad enough as a nationalist conceptualization to incorporate someone like Bob Marley? White nationalism, you can't imagine the KKK saying, hey, Bob, welcome in, right? So this is one of the reasons it's absurd to compare black nationalism and white nationalism. Black nationalism literally evolved in resistance to slavery. White nationalism literally evolved as justifying a means of owning other human beings. They're not comparable. Black nationalism and white nationalism are quite different. The recognition of colorism, the conversation about political blackness versus social blackness, all of that is internal conversations I'm happy to have. But I generally don't emphasize my mixedness publicly for a number of reasons. One, my political education came from the black radical tradition. I went to Pan-African Saturday School. I had an extracurricular African history class at my school. My godfather and the, you know, other members of the African Caribbean community gave my white mother the assistance her white community would not give her to raise her children. So I feel a tremendous sense of loyalty to that. Similarly, white society only tries to claim those of us that are mixed once we've done well.
Of course.
Mark Duggan's mixedness was irrelevant. He was a yardie, he was a gangster, he was a bad guy. In fact, the fact that he could be shot by the black on black violence police department should tell us something very profound about the way blackness is conceptualized. So I think it'd be very naive for those of us who are mixed, by all means, be proud of both sides of your heritage, but there is a racial conflict here that is not a conflict of equals.
It's worth remembering at this point that Akala's older sister is the multi-award winning rapper, singer and producer, Miss Dynamite. The things that you promote, fighting violence
like you don't want to grow. I remember when my sister was at the peak of her fame, the Daily Mail wrote an article, unsurprisingly, basically saying she's not really black. I mean, look how clever she is. That literally was basically the article.
Right.
She can't really be the voice of the black street. And they actually just made up stuff about us growing up with our Scottish family. Now, let's be clear. My mum's family is half Scottish, half English. The Scottish family were totally cool. They didn't care that we were brown. In fact, in a sense, they were kind of like, at least you're not English. Yeah. So they were not really bigoted, but they lived in Scotland. We didn't see them. Really. I went to Scotland once. My sister literally lived with my Jamaican grandmother when she moved out of the house because her and my mum weren't getting on. But the Daily Mail couldn't accept, as a lot of white people still find it hard to accept, that my intelligence, frankly, is a product of a black radical political tradition. I literally went to a Saturday school called the Winnie Mandela School, while some of my middle-class white teachers were putting me in special needs group for kids who don't speak English. And I was reading Lord of the Rings at home. I was forced to identify myself within that conflict and look at the absurdity that being half white in Jamaica made me high-coloured and an object of privilege. It meant people assumed I was intelligent, that I had money, all of this. Whereas being half black in England comes with the exact opposite implications. And so I think mixed identity has to be trodden very carefully.
I asked Simon Woolley what the black means in Operation Black Vote.
It's interesting that you asked that because the perception of that has changed over the years. So when we began in the 1990s, there was an international concept in which political black, it was internationalist, but driven really from a British Caribbean perspective in which non-white was black. And when you look at the Caribbean, when you look at the Caribbean countries, you know, the kaleidoscope of ethnicities which emerged from the independence movements of the Caribbean, that we were looking outwardly as internationalists. And we took that back to the UK and began this black political, which meant that people of colour faced a particular type of discrimination, broadly say racism, and that an Asian struggle was an African Caribbean struggle or African struggle, and that we were stronger united. Mm. Yes, we'd have our differences. Yes, most of them we celebrate, and our challenges. Mm. White supremacist society was built upon divide and rule. Mm. And so we knew we had to confront that. But what it meant was is that, that non-white collective could be galvanized in such a way that one, we could support each other, and two, politically, we could be uniquely extremely strong.
Is that the context that Operation Black Vote still works under?
It is. I think particularly since 9/11, when divide and rule was at its zenith, that the focus was on Muslims. And so other religions said, we're not Muslim. Hmm. They're the baddies. And so, you know, there's been a push to fragment our different communities. Some of young black activists have said, you know, we're African, we're not this political black, it's outdated. Mm. And I lament about that. I mean, you know, yes, I want to see black empowerment, African empowerment, but that golden thread of unity to confront persistent racism was true back then as it is today.
Diane Abbott spoke to me about that change in perception that Simon speaks of.
I think that as I say, the rise of a more individualist politics has its merits, but we've lost the notion of collectivism. Mm. So what people want to know is, I mean, for years, I ran two projects in parallel. One was London Schools and the Black Child, which is about black children education. And the other was Black Women in Business, which is about women entrepreneurs. And with Black Women in Business, we always found that the most popular events, which were events about how to make money, if the emphasis on individual advancement, which is, you know, very part and parcel of the Thatcher years and New Labour, hasn't helped to have a coherent and unified movement in the black community. Mm. And yet people can see what is happening to them as a community, and they lament what is happening to them as a community, but they don't quite see that unless we come together as a community, there is no real remedy. Mm. You can talk about it, you can write about it, you can say how dreadful it is, but unless you come together as a community, there's no real remedy.
I'm usually not the one calling for unity, and I think it has to be carefully done here so as not to flatten differences or ignore existing discrimination. But it's really clear to me that there needs to be some intergenerational dialogue. There may never be a consensus on political blackness, but we could learn a lot from each other. Angelica from Sisters Uncut is hopeful about the situation.
There's a problem with like knowledge not being passed down from our older activist foremothers and fathers. And I think sometimes with younger activists, myself included, there's a bit of an arrogance. We feel like, okay, we've got it all figured out. Like the older generation, like they don't know shit. Like they're old school, When actually we're experiencing a lot of the same things again and again. And they they were dealing with similar things.
Yeah. More viciously, more violently.
And like, there's this incredible like radical activist tradition in the UK. Mm. And I don't think all of that like knowledge has been completely like uncovered and passed down.
We're doing something new on About Race, which is using the platform to signal boost other podcasters who are doing excellent work. One of the first that I want to shout out is Stance Podcast, a really excellent arts, culture and current affairs podcast hosted by Crystal Genesis and Hetta Fell. I really like it. It's a bit like a really interesting Saturday supplement. So definitely tune into that. You can hear more on stancepodcast.com. About Race with Rennie Edo-Lodge is written by me. It's produced by Renee Richardson. Our researcher is Rez Marino, and our research assistant is Isis Thompson. Original music is by Matt Sidiso, and artwork is by Kevin Morosky. You can join the conversation using the hashtag AboutRaceWithRennie. Full transcripts and episodes are available on our website, aboutracepodcast.com. If you like what you hear, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the show on your favourite app. This podcast is funded by Arts Council England.